Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CURE Panel Talk Show on multiple myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at CURE Talk, and along with the CURE Talk team of Sharif Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. We will be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. This is CURE Panel Talk Show's 7th episode and discussing multiple myeloma, and we are nearing 30,000 replays of our broadcast. The next myeloma panel will feature renowned myeloma expert, Dr. Robert Olderski from MD Anderson on April 25th. Next week, we will also be hosting the first prostate cancer panel discussion jointly with the Prostate Cancer Foundation. Registrations are open for the event, and more details are available at trialx.com/curetalk. Today's CURE Panel Talk Show is on myeloma, features staff attorney, Cancer Legal Resource Center, Anya Prince, myeloma survivor, Amy Garofalo, and myeloma author, survivor, advocate, Pat Killingsworth. I extend my hearty welcome to all of you. The show is co-hosted by Matt Goldman. Matt was diagnosed with myeloma in 2011. Matt is a land use planner for the Port of Long Beach. He is currently undergoing maintenance treatment under Dr. James Berenson. Welcome to the show, Matt. Before I hand over to Matt, there are a few rules which would make your CURE panel experience smooth. If you're listening in to the panel through your phone as well as a computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on their keypads, and we will bring them online live. Matt would now introduce us to the panelists. Matt, you're live on air.
Okay. Thanks, Priya, and good afternoon, everybody. Before I get started, I just wanted to say I'm honored to have this opportunity to host this panel. My hope is that over the next hour we can provide some useful information to folks. As Priya said, I'm Matt Goldman. I was diagnosed about 24 months ago at the age of 49. As a quote-unquote younger patient, it's been a real challenge for me personally just to keep working and to making sure that I've stayed insured this whole time. There's a wealth of information out there about myeloma and treatment, but I've sort of found I had to find my own way in terms of working and making sure that I'm balancing my health and also, like I said, staying insured and staying employed. And again, that's why I think today's panel is super important. We have some great folks today. We have Amy Garofalo, who Priya mentioned, she's a myeloma patient who was diagnosed about 2 years ago. And I've actually come to know Amy through social media, and she's actually become a real big part of my support network. We have Pat Killingsworth, who was diagnosed in 2007 at the age of 51. And Pat actually is one of the first fellow myeloma patients who I even had contact with after my diagnosis. And then Anya Prince is an attorney with the Cancer Legal Resource Center here in Los Angeles, which is where I'm at. And I became aware of Anya's organization just when I was starting to have some issues about my job and my status at work, and sort of I was thinking I needed to reach out to get some assistance. So with that, why don't we let each of the panelists introduce themselves, and then we can get right to the questions. Amy, let's start with you.
Okay. I am on the East Coast. I live in Connecticut. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in April of 2011 at age 45. I was diagnosed just after a routine physical. All my the CBC count came back as aplastic anemia, and they immediately sent me to an oncologist's office, and after several blood tests and a bone marrow biopsy, I got the diagnosis of myeloma. I had a year of chemotherapy and then a stem cell transplant in April of 2012 at Dana-Farber. So I'm going on about a year after my stem cell transplant. And just taking it day by day, I've been working through all my treatments. I was the supervisor of the transcription department of a hospital, a local hospital where I live. But due to the multiple myeloma side effects, my job got changed. So I guess I'll get into that a little later.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Pat, how about you?
Well, hello, Matt and Amy.
Hi.
And
hey, Pat.
I'm down in Florida, so I guess we've got the country bracketed.
Yeah.
And I was diagnosed in April, too, Amy, so I'm coming up on my 6th year myeloma anniversary. Yay!
Wow.
I was in such bad shape when I was diagnosed. I was diagnosed so late. I had very bad bone damage, and I was sick. I mean, I could barely get out of bed. So I went on Social Security disability almost immediately. I was fortunate, I guess. Hopefully I can ask some questions about that with Anya tonight. So when I got my feet back on the ground, I continued my job as a realtor. I was a co-partner in a real estate firm that we opened. And so that gave me some flexibility. So I was able to wind down over about, maybe even 2 years. But I was self-employed, so that helped. And now I'm a freelance medical writer and author, and basically I write about my cancer. So, again, I've got some flexibility. If I don't feel good, if I need to get up and walk around every 10, 15, 20 minutes, because if I sit longer, it hurts so much I don't want to stand up, you know, that kind of thing. I'm not in a cubicle or a corner office, and it gives me a lot of flexibility.
All right. Thanks, Pat. And last but not least, how about you, Anya?
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. So my name is Anya, and I'm one of the staff attorneys at the Cancer Legal Resource Center. And what my organization does is we provide free legal information and resources to cancer patients all over the country. So we have a national telephone assistance line where individuals can call into our organization and ask questions about the legal side of cancer. And unfortunately, you know, there shouldn't be a legal side to cancer, but it really, going through cancer really does touch a huge array of laws in our field. So some of our, you know, Pat and Amy already touched on a couple of them of how to go about working with a diagnosis. So there's employment laws, there's also insurance laws, and access to government benefits such as the Social Security Disability Insurance that Pat mentioned. So our organization helps to give people resources about those laws that are available to them, and if necessary, try to match them up with an attorney in their area if it comes to that. But we really are an education model, not a litigation model. So we don't actually go to court for people. We find that giving individuals the tools to advocate for themselves really helps to make a difference, especially in the area of employment law, where knowing what your rights are can make a huge difference. So anybody, I'll answer some of the legal side of the questions, and I'm excited to hear some of the personal stories today as well. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm real excited. Yeah, a lot of the legal side of it is definitely a mystery to folks, and it's you learn as you go along. Let's get to the questions. And Pat and Amy, you already sort of touched on this, but Amy, why don't you describe a little bit your job before and after your diagnosis, how your job changed, and even talk about if you had to take some time off when you were first diagnosed, or how you sort of dealt with that transition from not having myeloma to having myeloma.
Okay. Well, for 15 years, I had run my own business. I had a small medical transcription company, so I worked at home, which was great. Flexibility was great. In September of 2010, I started working at hospital as supervisor of their transcription department. I oversaw 5 employees, 3 subcontractors, and a second transcription, a transcription vendor, and worked with them as they did half of our load of transcription for the hospital. So I started there in September of 2010, and 7 months later, I felt like I was still kind of getting used to the job. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, which, you know, was devastating in itself, but also with a pretty new job. I worked all through my 12 cycles of chemotherapy, you don't really know the legal side. Like Matt said, there's so much information out there on multiple myeloma and the treatments and where to go to, get the best treatment. But as far as what your rights are for a job and what your rights are working, there's not a lot. So I think this is great that Anya's going to give us some information on that. I did work up until my stem cell transplant, and then obviously had to take time off when I was in the hospital. And about a month afterwards, I was, in complete isolation at home. And then I slowly did start working from home a couple hours a day. I got the okay from my doctor, and then 4 hours, and then 6 hours a day from home. But then they decided that they couldn't keep me in my supervisor position anymore with I was going to be able to get back to work. So that was very difficult emotionally. I felt like I was working so hard to get back to that point, and I couldn't. So I am now just doing another woman took my job as supervisor, and I'm doing more of a quality assurance and kind of monitoring the system type of role right now, which affords me to be able to be at home. And eventually I want to get back into the office part-time, but I did have to step down from my position.
And when you had your stem cell transplant, how long were you out?
I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and then I was home and out of work for a month. And then I started back with 2 hours a day.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Pat, how about you? You in your introduction, you talked a little bit about your career before your diagnosis and then what you do now. Can you just give a little more detail about how you became a writer and a blogger and somewhat of a myeloma expert, how you made that transition?
Of course. And I don't want to talk too long because we've already established we've got lots of questions for Anya, but Patty, my wife Patty and I were the Pat and Patty team. You know, the obnoxious, smiling, high energy real estate list 100 houses a year, you know, power couple in a small town about an hour outside of the Twin Cities, just across the Wisconsin border. And so I had Minnesota, Wisconsin license, and we had a paid assistant, and, you know, we were rocking and rolling, and I had made my name by working long, long hours. People used to comment how they'd see my van parked outside the office at 8, 9, 10 o'clock on Sundays. And even after I got my feet back on the ground, that just wasn't possible anymore with the myeloma. So I could see I needed to wind things down in my home. You know, we had a beautiful, nice home on 5 acres on top of a hill surrounded by wildflowers with a view. I mean, it was really great. But it had a long driveway hilly driveway that I used to snow blow, and the road would get icy. You couldn't even go for a walk. There wasn't a sidewalk. It was a gravel road. You know, I mean, there, for a whole variety of reasons, I saw that wasn't going to work. So we relocated to Florida. We made a plan, and we relocated to Florida 2 years later. And so we lived down here for 4 years. But as I started researching myeloma, I was disappointed by the information that I was finding. So I just decided to jump in and share my story. And if I learned something, I wanted to pass it along. I love to double dip. I love to be efficient. So, you know, if I was learning something, why not help somebody else learn the same thing? I think that was part of the motivation. And the other thing is, you can write, you know, like I said, from home, if you're not feeling well. And so I went that route. I had a master's in education. I'd been a teacher and a drug and alcohol counselor in a previous life. So although I'd never been a writer and I wasn't trained, I think it was a fairly easy transition. The hardest part was, you know, spending so much time on a computer and, you know, peripheral neuropathy. It's not always easy to use a keyboard, but, you know, I've adjusted. I still don't have voice activated software. I'm still using, a keyboard and word processor, and I love it. I absolutely love it. It'd be great if I knew what I know now without having multiple myeloma, but you can't go there. So I just wanted, Matt, if I can, at some point, and yeah. Anya, I'd like the overwhelming amount of questions I get that are employment-related or somewhat employment-related all have to do with SSDI. You know, like if it's supposedly myeloma is an automatic approval, why no one gets approved, and they all need attorneys, and I was so sick. I mean, my wife, Patty, filled the information out, and we were approved, and I think sometimes it depends on the state. You know, if you're in a state like New York or Florida or California, I bet it's a lot harder to get approved. We were in Wisconsin, and we were approved right away, and that was fortunate. But if we could touch on that at some point, and I'm finished. Thanks.
Okay. Well, that's where we're heading now. Thanks. And Pat, thanks for everything you do, too. Just your information for me personally has been super helpful. I do work in a cubicle, and when I was first diagnosed, the first thought that went through my head is, wow, I'm never going to be able to work again, and I'm 49 years old. And I really wasn't sure where to turn or even what to tell my employers at the time. So that's the first question for you, Anya. What is an employee required to tell their employer, or even a prospective employer, about their diagnosis, about their treatment, and about their future, so to speak?
Sure. So that's a question we get a lot at the Cancer Legal Resource Center. And the good news is that an employee or a prospective employee actually does not have to disclose any diagnosis at all to their employer. And the employer also can't ask about a diagnosis. So they can't say, oh, I see you've been pretty tired lately. Do you have cancer? Now, there are some sometimes when an employee might have to disclose the information. And that's if they're asking for a reasonable accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act, or if they're asking for time off through medical leave, like the Family and Medical Leave Act. So I can talk a little bit more about those programs later on in the show, but the initial piece of information is that the employee doesn't have to disclose the diagnosis or the condition unless they're asking for those accommodations or leave. And then even within those requests for accommodation, the diagnosis itself actually doesn't have to be disclosed. So if your doctor is writing a note that says that's asking for an accommodation or for medical leave, all it needs to say is that it's a, you know, that it's a serious medical condition, or state what the accommodation is needed. So, you know, the individual can't sit for long periods of time, so they're going to have breaks where they can stand up and walk around the office. But it doesn't have to say that's because of a myeloma diagnosis. And that's something that's really important for patients to tell their doctors, because a lot of times the forms that the employer sends to the doctor have a little spot for diagnosis. So the doctors just fill it out because they're just going through the steps. But if the patient can tell their doctor, please don't fill out that diagnosis. And also, if you're doing that, don't have your oncologist fill out the paperwork, but have a general practitioner fill out the paperwork. That way there's not a key that it's a cancer-related.
And the follow-up to that, if an employee feels that their employer is not necessarily making reasonable accommodations for them or not giving them their rights under FMLA, what is the employee's what are their options for remedying that?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different options. So under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires certain employers to give reasonable accommodations to individuals with disabilities, if that's not happening, one is to just send a formal letter and, you know, go through the internal process of requesting it. But if the employer is not following up, then you can file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or the EEOC, and that gives a formalized complaint to the employer. If this is happening, you know, anybody can give our organization a call and we can walk through the steps. And we have sample accommodation letters and sample requests for leave letters that people, sort of the Mad Libs type fill-in-the-blank leave letters that you can send to your employer if that's as the first initial step. So we have a lot of resources on our website that can help people. But then there are, the next step would be a complaint with the agency, whether it's DOL for FMLA, the Department of Labor for the Family and Medical Leave Act, or the EEOC for ADA, as I mentioned. And then eventually there could be a court case if through those processes the employer still hasn't accommodated properly.
Okay. Let me jump around a little bit. Back to you, Amy. Just going back to working and the importance of working, would you say that for you working, was important for you to stay working just to have some normalcy in your life? Was it important because of insurance, because of making sure you get the income? What's the driving force between wanting to keep working after your diagnosis?
Definitely financial. Luckily, I'm insured under my husband's employer. So if, you know, I couldn't continue working, I would still have insurance. But, yeah, definitely to keep some normalcy in my life, financial reasons. When you get diagnosed with cancer, I mean, it's very easy to kind of crawl up into bed and curl up into bed and stare at a wall because it's shocking. So I felt that I could get up every day while I could and get out there and keep some normalcy in my life. So that definitely financial and definitely for routine and normalcy in my life.
Right. And Pat, what about you? As you were self-employed and now you're an author, how do you deal with the insurance question of not having an employer that can provide your insurance for you?
Well, of course, that's a whole other issue. Before I start, though, Anya, so having cancer, I'm guessing it's not a protected class.
The cancer itself, in and of itself, is not a protected class, but having a disability is a protected class. And under the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's defined as somebody who is substantially limited in a major life activity. And so oftentimes cancer can substantially limit a major life activity, such as walking, talking, breathing, or the operation of major bodily functions. So it's really an individualized assessment, but oftentimes cancer falls under that. And in some state laws, cancer is specifically listed, so it's easier for an employee to show that if they have cancer, it's a disability. But it's really an individualized assessment.
Sure. The reason I ask is I'm not sure how comfortable I would have been not disclosing something so serious to my employer. What's the disadvantage of doing that?
Well, legally, you're not required to tell the employer. And then it's just, you know, dependent on the person's employment situation. So some people might work for very supportive environments where having people in the office or in the job place know about the diagnosis. That might be a supportive thing, you know, where people ask about how they're doing and it's a positive experience. But some people work in places where they might be nervous about discrimination. And unfortunately, at the CLRC, we have seen people be discriminated against based on a cancer diagnosis. Now, I don't think that's necessarily the norm in society, but of course, we hear all the bad actors because those are the calls we get. So we always, you know, tend to be a little bit more cautious about having people disclose that because it is their right not to have that disclosed. And because it's their right not to disclose that diagnosis, there shouldn't be a downside to that. You know, if the employer finds out that there's been a cancer diagnosis, they can't say, "Oh, you should have told me," because that it's the person's right not to disclose that.
Of course, I understand that from a legal standpoint, but with social media and you get a Caring Bridge site, and yeah, I can see that. Where that'd be a double-edged sword, your supervisor, who you go out and watch, you go to Buffalo Wild Wings and watch the NCAA tournament with, and they think you're close, and then they find out you didn't even tell them that you had cancer. That I could see how that could get a little awkward, or people walk into your office and you're crying, or, you know, it just seems to me like it would be a tough thing to keep secret.
I mean, it's, again, a very individualized decision. Some people enjoy having everybody sort of in their life and get that support, and some people want to take that journey either alone or just with family. But it is tough, and I think, like you said, be aware of what you put out there on social media and what your employer might find out. Now, legally, even if the employer has information about the diagnosis, they still can't discriminate based on that disability. So even if you decide to tell your employer that you have multiple myeloma or another disability, they can't say, "Oh, well, now that you've told me, we're going to fire you or we're going to treat you differently." They have to, under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the requirements are to not discriminate based on the disability and to also give reasonable accommodations. So those are the two pieces of the law that are important.
Well, that's really great to know. Matt asked me about insurance, and part of this two-year plan that we had to relocate, with all the bone damage I had, I decided warm was better. So no more his and her dog sled teams, no more ski school instruction. Heck, if I fell, took a hard fall, my body would go one direction and my head would probably roll the other way. I had so much damage at the base of my neck. So we came up with this plan to move to Florida, but one of the primary concerns I had was insurance. And I had Blue Cross Blue Shield, a good major medical policy, self-employed, and large deductible, but at least after I reached that deductible, I think it was $5,000, everything was covered. So at least it covered the big stuff. And when I tried to transfer to Blue Cross in Florida, even though they're owned by the same company, their affiliate of the same company, they would not give me a guarantee in writing that I could make the switch. So I knew that wasn't going to work. Social Security disability right about the time I was switching. I was able to, I was eligible for Medicare. So I could have gone the Medicare route, but I was concerned about, for example, the limit of one transplant, and there are a number of other reasons. And cost. It's not that inexpensive if you get a good supplemental policy. So fortunately, my wife with Cigna Insurance had a good policy, and I decided that that was the route to take. So when we moved, I became part of my wife's policy at work. So does that help, Matt? I just think people have to be really careful, get things in writing. I'm sure Anya can jump in on some of that. But.
Yeah, that helps. And I know, Pat, I know we're sort of jumping around a lot. I just wanted to make sure we touch on a whole bunch of topics. It feels like an hour is not even enough, but that was very helpful. Thanks. And I'll just add that with me when I was diagnosed, and since then, I've been fairly open about my condition and how I'm doing and what I'm doing. And for me, it just that felt like. The legal question aside, it just felt like the right way to do it. I think it helped me actually deal with the diagnosis. As Amy said, it's pretty shocking, and I think being open about it has allowed me to deal with it. Sometimes with work, I do wonder if maybe I should tone it down a little. I mean, I don't go around screaming I have cancer, but sometimes I wonder if I should back off a little bit, but... Again, like Anya said, I think it's a personal decision how you deal with it when you put aside the legal part of it. Going back to you, Amy, how do you deal with, as we all know, and I think as we've all learned, with cancer and with myeloma, we really want to minimize our stress, the stress in our life and stress from outside sources. And we also want to be careful. We have lowered immune systems. You know, we want to be careful to not be around too many people who are too sick. So with working, how, Amy, do you deal with the stress of work and even with potentially sick coworkers? You know, we're just coming out of the flu season. How do you handle that?
Yeah, so I have not gone back into the office yet, and that's part of the reason why. Once I had to step down from my position, as supervisor, I was able to take a little more time before getting back into the office. As it was right about the time that flu season was hitting in November, I guess. And I decided it was very open. With my managers, them right, I've diagnosed. So part of their grand plan, with me in mind, minimizing the stress and giving me the ability to have more time to recuperate. After my stem cell transplant, my white blood counts and my ANC, my absolute neutrophils, have not been able to be normal on their own. I have to take, give myself a Neupogen injection every week. So I'm kind of, because that part of my immune system did not come back, I'm at higher risk. And so I'm actually waiting for the flu season to be over. It hit our hospital pretty hard. There was about a month that they were making all visitors at the hospital wear masks and gloves. All the employees at the hospital were wearing masks and gloves. The outpatient cancer center that I went to, anytime I walked in there, we were all wearing masks and gloves. So, you know, how I dealt with it was lucky enough I could work from home, but I am planning on going back into the office month, and I do work in a cubicle, so I'm going to arm myself with Purell, and if a sickness starts going around the office, I'm going to work from home and stay away from sick contacts as much as possible. just like you have to do in the you know, in everyday life anyway.
Well, wash your hands a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that's a good segue to the question for you, Anya. How does somebody, and this is a question that I think one of the listeners had sent in to Priya, in terms of reasonable accommodations, how does somebody like Amy or somebody that really is around a lot of people or even a nurse who's been diagnosed, that has to be that careful in terms of who they're around, and reasonable accommodations, does job training or education fall under that umbrella in terms of helping out an employee?
Yeah, it could. So reasonable accommodation is a great thing to think about in this context. So what a reasonable accommodation is it's just a change or modification to the workplace or to the structure of the job to allow somebody, an individual with a disability, to perform the essential functions of the job. So an accommodation for this could be maybe if there's a requirement for an in-person meeting once a week, maybe the person stays at their cubicle and calls into the meeting on a conference line. So even if they're in the office and required to be in the office, you know, they're not in the room with the whole entire group. Or if it's possible, maybe it's working from home, as Amy has done. You know, that's not always an option for every single job, but that can be a form of a reasonable accommodation. And I think the flip side of a reasonable accommodation is that it cannot be an undue burden on the employer. So what that often comes down to is cost. So if it's going to be prohibitively expensive for the employer, then it may be an undue burden. And so that definition is going to switch for who the employer is. So if it's a 20-person small business, one reasonable accommodation might be an undue burden for that employer, whereas it wouldn't be for a larger employer. But you know, the accommodations to think of in cases of the immunity is, you know, if there's a strict dress code, then allowing somebody to wear a face mask during the employment could be an option. And I think, as you mentioned, training other employees about, you know, coughing and making sure to keep their hands clean and not come to work sick, I think that could also be an interesting reasonable accommodation. And so when an employee requests an accommodation, what's supposed to happen is it starts a dialogue with the employer. Legally, it's called the interactive process. So an employer cannot just say, no, we're not giving you that accommodation. So let's say Amy had told her employer, you asked her employer, can I work from home as a reasonable accommodation? And the employer said, no, that's going to be an undue burden on us. But how about we have you do X, Y, or Z? So they can't just say no. They have to work with the individual to come up with a solution. And then if there's no solution available, then, you know, they've tried to do that. But it really is an ongoing, continuing process. So being creative in what to ask for, especially those little things that don't cost any money and just require the employer to have a little bit of time, are really great in this scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think for all of us, I think for myeloma patients, in many ways, it's a chronic disease, and I've heard a lot of other patients say, and I've said it too. A lot of people, when they look at us, they don't think that we have cancer, and they think that we're perfectly fine. And I think sometimes that makes it a little bit difficult as an employee, you know, to get that message across to your employer that some things need to be a little bit different. And I think that's a hurdle that myeloma patients and cancer patients fight, is everyone has a perception of what a cancer patient looks like, and that's not always the case.
I think that's an excellent point, and if I could just add, I think what we see at the CRC is also the flip side of that, where sometimes people have a perception of what somebody's ability to work is as a cancer patient that's completely different. So maybe they think you can't do a job even though you can. And that actually is also discrimination under the Americans with Disabilities, is regarding somebody as being more disabled than they actually are, or just being disabled if the cancer has been affecting them. So that's also illegal under the ADA.
Tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah. Pat, back to you. Just going back to the question of the stress of working and what's balancing what you need to do for your health versus the need to work or the desire to work. Do you think what you do now has been good for your health? That one, understanding myeloma better, and two, being your own boss and like you said, being able to get up from your computer every so often, I would imagine that's you would say that's been good for your health, correct?
So I suppose if I just say yes, 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 and yes, Amy made a really good point. Yes, working, feeling useful, feeling like you're contributing, is good for your head, your heart, and your soul. And I made the decision early on that if I wasn't going to be around very long, I was going to make every minute count. And it's just a decision I made. It's not right for everyone, but I made the decision that I was going to try to help as many of my fellow patients and caregivers as I could. And it's been very, very energizing. But another advantage is, now my wife is a 3-time cancer survivor. So we don't have children. She wasn't able to have children. Working from home with no kids, it really helps me. I don't get sick very often. Once in a while, I'm just getting over a cold. I get the sense of what it's like to get cold after cold after cold when your immune system is compromised and you've had a stem cell transplant, for example. But I'm pretty fortunate, and I think my wife takes it personally, but it seems like every time that I see her nieces, she has two young nieces, 7, 8, 9 years old, and it seems like every time we go to one of their birthday parties or something else, 3-4 days later, I'm sick. So I'm really fortunate to be able to work from home. I don't isolate myself intentionally, but those kids are carriers. So if you're in an office of 24 people and, wow, during flu season, yeah, that would be difficult. So I'm fortunate.
Yeah. And again, for you, Pat, I've found with me as over the 2 years, as I've felt better and I've gotten better, there's times that I even forget about the myeloma, and I'll let myself get stressed out about certain things at work, and I have to give myself a little reminder to not get too stressed. Can you, in the research that you've done, is there any sort of documentation about the correlation? And this is a question that one of the listeners had sent in. Is how much information is there out there about the correlation between stress and the relapse potential of myeloma?
Sure. And there, you know what? And I have researched it, and I'm writing a book, and that's a large component. And, living, how to live better with this cancer that we have. And I'm telling you, they aren't myths. They aren't necessarily not true. They're grounded in some fact, I believe. But it's very hard to find proof, for example, that a positive attitude helps you live longer. I've been trying to track that one down, and there isn't much. Of course, what drug company is going to do an expensive, trial on that? But there isn't a lot of, university research on that. The same goes for stress. Common sense tells us that to be really stressed, for example, it would be difficult if you lost a parent or a sibling or someone died or if you were moving or any of those things, that you're more likely to get sick. But I don't think there's any proof that it leads to a faster myeloma relapse, for example. And I would even argue the opposite. I'm a type A personality, and to be somewhat active and stressed, I guess, is in my nature. And, it would be hard to say that I'm not going to live as long. Heck, I could argue I'd live longer because I have a reason to live and I'm more active and all of those. These are hard things to prove. I know that they tell you, don't get stressed, and then you stress about getting stressed.
Right. So when's your book coming out?
It's actually my first book that I've never finished. It's even been partially edited. Julie Shalane at the Myeloma Beacon, my editor on the project, and I've just decided I wanted to get the myeloma specific books out first. This is a Living a Longer and Better Life with Cancer. This is one that might actually sell more than 2,000 copies, you know. So I need to get back to that, actually. Oh God, now I'm stressed.
All right, well, we'll take it easy. I'd like to get to some listeners' questions. I had several submitted, and I think we've kind of touched on most of them. So maybe Priya, do we have some other questions that folks submitted?
Yes, Matt, we'll ask for questions now. Callers, you'll be now brought live to ask your questions. You may press 1 if you have a question for our Cure panel. Callers may press 1 if you have a question for the panel. But maybe you should complete some of the, we should address some of the submitted questions.
Okay.
The one by David Baker about SLMA, maybe Anya could touch on that.
Yeah. One question, we received, Anya, a question from someone that says they were just terminated from their employment. Their employer said that their FLMA had expired and they could not keep getting extensions. What can that specific person do?
Yeah, so what the FLMA is it's a federal law that gives unpaid but job-protected and health benefit-protected leave. And that leave lasts for 12 weeks. Now, it only applies to certain employers and certain employees, so not everybody has this right. But if you do have the right, then you get 12 weeks of job protection, where you can take time off to care for yourself or a family member. Now, after those 12 weeks, unfortunately, an employer is not required to continue that leave. But, as I mentioned, there's reasonable accommodations under the ADA. So one strategy is to ask the employer whether an extension of that leave would be a reasonable accommodation. Now, this is going to be a harder sell to the employer. You know, it's going to be harder to say that that's a reasonable accommodation than, you know, having 15-minute rest breaks, because it may be an undue burden on the employee, on the employer, to have to fill in that time. Courts have held that extending FMLA can be a reasonable accommodation in some situations, but what they've found is that it has to be a definite time period. So your doctors and you have to be able to say, I'll return in 3 weeks or 1 month, or I need 3 more months. And obviously, that the further you extend out, the more likely it is that that's going to be an unreasonable accommodation. But it's definitely worth asking for that. Unfortunately, if somebody can't return to work, then you might want to look into disability insurance programs, which Pat had mentioned, the Social Security Disability Insurance, which is a long-term disability insurance through Social Security Administration. We also have a supplemental security income, which is another long-term disability insurance program. And some states have state disability insurance, and then there's private disability plans as well. So I could talk for 2 hours on all of that. So if you have questions about that, feel free to give our organization a call. We have resources on it. And it's a really tricky area, not just to begin with. The programs are SSI, SSDI, and SDI, which is just confusing enough to start with. So it's tough, but that's something that people can look into, is wage replacement programs such as disability insurance.
Matt, could I ask Anya a question?
Oh, absolutely.
Anya, I know two people who both the same company, coincidentally, so they went on short-term disability, and right before they were ready to qualify for long-term disability, they both got fired. Mm-hmm. I mean, both of them were fired within 3 days of starting their long-term disability, which was a benefit of their job. Can these companies really do that?
So the, you know, standard attorney answer, which I'll give, is it depends, which it really does. So employers can't fire people for discriminatory reasons against somebody who has a disability. They can terminate people if it's an at-will employment for no cause whatsoever. The tricky thing is, how does one actually prove that that's why they fired them? So in court cases, you know, that might be a situation where we would refer a caller to one of our professional panel attorneys and try to match them up with an attorney, because that attorney can bring up evidence to show that it was discriminatory. So showing circumstantial evidence, such as there's two people who were both in a similar situation who were fired at the same time. But employment actions can be very hard to prove. So it really is, it's tough. It's tough to decide whether you want to do that, and especially as we're having a discussion about keeping stress levels down, you know, people have to make the personal choice of, you know, even if I think that I've been wronged, is a court case what I want to do right now? Because it can be
That's just cold.
What's that?
I said, that's just cold. That's all.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So it can be tough. But we do have resources about employment discrimination, because we do see it happen, and if people want to sue their employers, we definitely give them the resources and try to give referrals out to have that be an option, because it can be a good option in some situations. It's just, again, a really individualized choice depending on the situation.
Listeners, if you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypads and we'll bring you live on air to ask your question.
Priya, I have a question that you had sent me from one of the listeners, and maybe this would be for Amy. Someone said that they're a nurse as well as a multiple myeloma patient. Are there any contacts out there for someone in her position in terms of how she can make a living when nursing becomes too demanding?
That's a really good question. I don't actually know of any particular contacts, but I know that I know a lot of nurses do things from home. They don't have to do patient care, whether it's like medical record reviews or quality assurance of medical records. They can work for insurance companies reviewing claims. They can also work for insurance companies. Like when I was going through my transplant, I had my particular insurance had a whole bone marrow transplant, stem cell transplant team, which called and checked on me, like in the beginning, every other week, and then slowed down to every month, getting information from me after my stem cell transplant. And I know that a lot of these things are done from home. I could imagine, I can't even imagine how a nurse would do her job in a hospital working with patients all day long, you know, with potentially, you know, very bad illnesses, flu and transmittable illnesses, and plus, you know, they have to be accountable for getting into their job however many hours. A lot of them are working 12-hour shifts now, and I just, you know, being a myeloma patient, I can't imagine being on my feet and being stressed and working that hard like nurses do for 12 hours a day. So I don't know any particular context, but I know that, you know, having an RN degree doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be in a hospital.
Right. And this is a question for all of you, and maybe Pat, for you. for you
specifically. I have a question from our listener.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The person calling from 225-313, please ask your question.
I was just listening. I myself, my name's Don Thomas, and I work at a hospital myself as a mental health tech. And just recently I was taken off the floor because of the fact that with my immune system, you know, and the stress, you know, I got shingles because of the stress itself. And due to the fact that I was losing a lot of time on, you know, between the chemo and the shingles, you know, they were, the company, you know, at first they were giving me options like, you can go on Cobra, which in my back of my head was like, well, you're going to fire me, you know. But then they came up with an option where, you know, I could work in the supply area, which needed a lot of work, and I got it straightened up. So they accommodated me for now, and I'm just wondering, you know, what if later on, because we're in the process of being bought out by another hospital, can this other hospital come back and say, well, we don't need you anymore?
So I can take that one if you want. So when an employer gives a reasonable accommodation, that can't be the end of the conversation because people change and their needs change depending on what the treatments they're going through, what stage of recovery is. So that interactive process that I was talking about earlier really is supposed to be a continuing process that changes over time. So the employer, if they give one accommodation and that's, you know, no longer sufficient or something else needs to happen, they have to continue to try to give other accommodations. Now, if there are no other accommodations that can be made, then at that point, if an individual isn't able to do the job, then the employer can terminate the employment, but they have to try to go through that reasonable accommodation process first. So they can't just say, oh, well, now we don't want to give you that accommodation anymore. They have to show why that would be an undue burden to them and then go through the termination process.
Yeah, I mean, as long as I've been working in supply, I mean, I was diagnosed with MM in August. I started treatment in Christmas Eve. About a month later, you know, I was, you know, walking around. I was weak and tired. You know, they noticed that, and I didn't hide anything from them, you know. And actually, I wanted to educate them on what I had, you know. So, main thing is, you know, I took over the supply area, and, you know, it's squared away like it should be. And so I can't see why they wouldn't keep me there, because, you know, it's better than it was.
Yeah, and that's an example of a reasonable accommodation working well, where it's helping out the employer and helping out the employee. And, you know, that's the type of situation where if something does change, you know, you can call our organization and we can talk through the steps at that point of what the options are and what communications you could give.
All righty. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Pat, I have a quick question for you. You talked about disability and Medicare. Do you know, are there any programs out there for folks who do want to go back to school because they feel like they need to do something different, for instance, a nurse who says they can't be a nurse anymore? Are there opportunities out there for middle-aged folks with myeloma to get re-educated?
Well, I believe SSDI actually has a program like that. I've considered doing it myself, where you're protected, I believe, for 5 years, and they can't terminate your benefits, and there seem to be some other advantages, too. I can't think. You know, everybody seems to be willing to give give school loan money these days. You see this stuff on 60 Minutes all the time that sometimes these schools are too aggressive. So, I suppose it would be a good time to try to go back to school and do something. I know we're right at the end, but Anya, I really wonder. My understanding is since myeloma is incurable, it's supposed to be pretty much an automatic SSDI deal. So I don't understand why more and more patients seem to be getting turned down, and then they have to bring an attorney in. And it just, could you explain that, please?
Yeah. So unfortunately, the way the Social Security Administration system works is many people here know the first time around, and it's just a heartbreaking system because the people who need it most are the ones who then are required to go through the appeals system if they want the benefits. So that, unfortunately, we see that often. It's a very individualized assessment, and the definition of disability is a little different than the ADA definition, but it's a medically determinable physical or mental impairment that prevents you from doing substantial gainful activity. So that's what the Social Security Administration is looking at, is does your individual diagnosis prevent you from doing substantial gainful activity? So as we've heard, a lot of people are able to work through treatment, and so they might not qualify for SSDI, even though it's the same diagnosis, so it's the individual assessment. But this is an area where we really encourage people to appeal the system, and the attorneys in this field are really highly regulated by the Social Security Administration, so they are limited in the amount that they can charge to an individual up front, and they work on what's called a contingency fee, where if you win the case at the end, they take a percentage. But they also are capped at how much of a percentage and how much money they can take from the individual at the end. So it's thankfully a field that it's pretty easy to get an attorney for a reasonable cost. And there are legal aids that sometimes help with the appeals for free if somebody can't afford one. So that's also an area where we can get referrals as well. But it is really tough to see different people getting those when they would hear a yes at the end of the appeal system. It's a very, very frustrating system.
Thank you. That's very helpful and very encouraging, actually.
Okay.
We're coming to the end of our show time. Amy, Anya, and Pat, it was great having you here. Thank you very much. Matt, it was a wonderful discussion. Thanks a lot. Your talk thanks all the listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next panel on April 25th. Please visit trilex.com/curetalk for further information, and MMRF website myelomatrilex.com or trilex.com/ask for information regarding clinical trials. Thank you. Thanks a lot. It was great having all of you here. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Matt. Great idea.
Yeah, I hope this helped some people out, and we got some information out there.
We should do a follow-up, actually.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Okay, thank you, Priya.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks.